Welcome to the Legacy Podcast. This podcast is a series of conversations centered around understanding the values, beliefs, and intentions behind leaving a legacy. You will hear from successful business owners just like yourself who want to leave an impact for generations to come. Let's get started. Welcome to the Business Legacy Podcast. I'm your host, Paul Dio. I have a very special guest. That's Andrew Drummond of Ski the Whites. Andrew, welcome.
Hey, Paul. Thanks for having me.
So randomly, I have a group of friends, college friends, and we talk about, you know, cool things to do, skiing, maybe snowboarding, sometimes mountain biking. And randomly in a conversation, your website came in our group chat and the message was, this guy is living the life. And so I figured it might be an interesting conversation above and beyond the normal business conversations that we have to get to know Andrew and what he's all about, because I think all of us need some type of intention and awareness around nature and being able to appreciate nature. So Andrew, welcome.
Yeah, that's a great point. And it's fun for me, as I was saying, to do a little introspection myself on the business side and not just look at it like this completely outdoors, fun-having lifestyle. There's a lot to it. And I'm constantly reminded of that day to day as things grow and get bigger. And I'm struggling to get a system in place to make everything work so that I can still enjoy the outdoors. We're up here in the White Mountains and there's always fun stuff to do.
Now, tell us a little bit about how it all began and how it evolved.
My story is pretty, I guess it's very interesting from how I got into becoming a business owner. I grew up in New Hampshire. I went to high school and college in Maine. I had a biology degree and didn't realize that, you know, with biology, most people go to med school, they do research or they become a teacher, but there's this business biology aspect of it where environmental consulting sort of caught my attention. That drew me out to San Diego in 2005. I lived out in San Diego for this job that I thought was going to be it, the end all career path, using my degree to do environmental consulting in San Diego. And so within a few months there, I found my job and I thought it was great. Really small company, woman owned, a couple other employees, and got to do a little bit of everything and really apply everything I'd learned in college. But as you know, say like I'm 24, 25, 26, I wanted to travel and do all this other stuff. Part of the draw to San Diego was to go surf. And I found myself getting more responsibility the longer I was at this job. And I was taking that responsibility home with me. I felt the stress of it. And I didn't get much time off. I have family back here in New Hampshire. I was coming back here for a lot of weddings and a lot of just my vacation time was sucked up. And there was all this other stuff I wanted to do with traveling and just not working, I guess. So what happened was I had a friend from high school who he came out and visited me in San Diego, and he had this job where he was on these oil exploration boats as a marine mammal observer. And his job was to look for whales, dolphins, and sea turtles.
Oh, wow.
And I'm thinking, I'm still in the honeymoon period with my job. I kept that in the back of my head. And fast forward when I'm in this flux trying to like evaluate my priorities in life. And he sends this email to me that's really funny. It's like talking about how hard his job is, the struggles. And he's in Mozambique, he's in Africa. And at the end of it, there's a photo and he's in a hot tub with binoculars. And I'm like, how do I get this job? This guy is in Africa in a hot tub looking for whales, dolphins, sea turtles, and whatever else. So that quickly got me thinking. I'm like, all right, I have to leave this job because I'm not satisfied. My friend has this other job where he works maybe half the year. And then the other half is free time. So that was a huge moment. It was like when I realized to prioritize what's important in your life. So I made the change and I did the training. I applied for these jobs. I ended up in Hawaii as part of the National Marine Fisheries Service doing a couple longline tuna monitoring jobs. So that was a nice little stint there before I got into these oil exploration jobs. They use air compression and hydrophones to really map thousands of feet below the ocean floor. And you can determine what oil reserves and potential drilling locations are, where they're going to be and what they're going to hold. And anywhere there's ocean, they're searching. And so for the next several years, I got to go to Africa four times, went to India, I went to Vietnam, I went to South America, some work in Gulf of Mexico, but ultimately did this job where I got to travel. So I was like, this is great for now. I knew it wasn't going to be the end all. And during that time, my time off, I'd either come back here to New Hampshire, spend some time in the mountains. I was surfing a lot in Mexico, because just across the border of San Diego, you have Baja, the Baja Peninsula, and there's tons of great surfing there. And then my brother's in Alaska. So my brother's in Anchorage, Alaska. I was visiting him there, and that's where I got introduced to backcountry skiing. So for those not familiar with backcountry skiing, it's like sort of the bread and butter of what I do. It's a lot of, it combines like my passion for the mountains with alpine skiing, but it's all human powered for the most part. So it all just sort of came to a point where 34 at the time, it's like, what do you want to do with your life? And I knew that living on boats wasn't it. It was just that afforded me the ability to travel and have some time off. But I knew I wanted to come back here to New England where I had roots, I had family. And I had this like really strong affinity for the White Mountains. And so I moved back here with my girlfriend and just decided that, all right, here I am, 34 years old, starting from scratch. What do you do with your life? That's a big thing. So say I spent 2 years not working almost. Like I started up a little business doing fish fertilizer with a buddy in Portland, Maine on the coast, which was a fun project, but ultimately failed. And not failed, but it ran out of steam and I ran out of money. Here we are. Like I'd saved up all this money from the boat stuff. What do you do when you have no money, but you have all this experience in life, and how do you apply it? And I just did what felt right at the time. And that was spend time in the mountains. That was taking photos and videos. It was skiing. It was hiking. I got into trail running and all this other stuff. And it's just funny when you think about it, because it just seemed, it's like pretty cliche when you say like, just, you know, kind of follow your heart, what makes sense. But it's like, what do you enjoy doing? What do you have the most fun doing? And I knew that I always had things to like perhaps fall back on. So I was open to taking a risk. I'm like, here we are in the White Mountains, one of these places I truly love and I think are underrepresented in media. And I think they're beautiful. And how can I showcase them? So I spent a lot of time becoming an expert in the terrain here and documenting it along the way. And so I started taking videos, and both ski videos, hiking, and built out a little YouTube channel. And it was a lot of fun, but like, it's not paying the bills. It's not doing anything. My girlfriend was like, didn't really get it, you know. Friends would ask what I do for work and she wouldn't know what to say. And I get it. Like that makes, you know, imagine someone working 40 plus hours a week and their other half is, it looks like they're just out playing in the mountains. This was in 2014, 2015. And summer 2015, I met Scott Jurek. He's an ultra runner. He's won these 100-mile races, Western States 7 times. He's someone that I'd read about and got me excited about pushing myself and seeing how far I could go in both like, you know, running and skiing and applying myself to this endurance world. I got linked up with him because when he was doing an Appalachian Trail through hike for the speed record, he was getting help in certain regions, and White Mountains are probably one of the hardest regions on the Appalachian Trail. It's about 100 miles with 30,000+ vertical feet, really technical terrain. He asked around and all fingers pointed back towards me because I was the guy. I developed the reputation as the guy who'd be available, who could help him in the White Mountains, because that's what I've been doing for the past year, 2 years. So it's very serendipitous, like this, how this happened, but it was kind of the work I'd put in. And meeting him made me think about my life and how am I challenging myself? And so that got me to do some athletic pursuits. Like the next summer, I spent the year sort of training to do my own project in the White Mountains, where I climbed all 4,000 footers in a single push on foot, not driving from trailhead to trailhead, but doing it in just under 6 days, sleeping on the trail and doing all the logistics, packing all my own food. And that was like the moment where I was like, all right, like I'm capable, we're all capable of doing these big things and things that excite you. So then now I'm like out of money, right? I applied myself in a way I hadn't applied myself before. And that fall, I had a friend that was in the ski industry, and he has been helping me out with ski gear from this brand Fisher since 2006. And now we're in like 2015, 16. And he's like, why don't you open a dealer account and help us sell gear? And I couldn't really understand. I was thinking, well, am I a rep? Do I work for Fisher? And he's like, no, you open up a dealer account and then you can sell our brand, Fisher. And so I was like, okay. He made it out to be like, I didn't have to carry inventory. It wasn't going to cost me anything. I just get like a run of ski gear that I can let people use, demo it, rent it, whatever. And when they want to buy it, I just put in the order and they ship it. Their warehouse is in New Hampshire and they send it over. Then I can start this little business. And that got me thinking, all right, this is what I'm going to do now. And I'm going to give this a shot. That was the birth of Ski the Whites and what we are now.
Amazing. Now, how long did it take to plan for the trek, the 4,000 foot?
Oh, I had a year. I had like a year to think about it because it was pretty much when Scott Jurek finished his Appalachian Trail record, I instantly was thinking, what's going to excite me? I thought the Appalachian Trail is too long, too much time. He did it in like 43 days. And I'm like, I don't have 43 days and I don't even think I could do it anywhere close to that. But I was like, well, what can I do that's big enough to fail? That was important for me because I didn't just want to do something that anyone could do. I wanted to do something that there was a strong likelihood it wasn't going to work out. That's where I really found the challenge. So I definitely spent the better part of that next year just chipping away and applying all these things like training and planning. And in the planning, there's other people that had done it before me in a little over 8 days. And so this whole carrot of doing it in under a week was the motivation.
Was there any indication that, or any semblance of hope before you determined the project that it would be possible? Like what gave you that confidence that it was worth trying, even though you might fail?
I think, and this really applies to business, you don't really think about the failure. You do it because you're motivated to do it and you'll do it at all costs. I don't think I would really do it if I thought I was going to fail it. You know, of course, I know and I'm aware that there's a lot of things that are outside of your control that could certainly shut it down. You know, there's crazy weather up here. There's gear issues. There's nutritional stuff that you're learning. You don't know how much you need to eat each day. And so how much you have to bring with you, and then how much can you sustainably carry and still move at a decent pace. So I think a lot of it, I was pretty confident. It was sort of my own way of internal way of protecting myself.
At what point were you about to quit? Do you remember? Do you remember any point where you're just like, you know what? Maybe I got in a little bit in over my head on this project.
Yeah, I learned a ton. I didn't know many people that had fast packed in the style before. I completely underestimated the summer temperatures. I mean, it was still getting in the 50s. Temperatures were in the 50s, and trying to sleep in the 50s without a sleeping bag, with a bivy sack and some long underwear and maybe a lightweight down jacket, just not enough. And you're so depleted. And so I would be shivering at night and I'd wake up at like 3 or 4 in the morning. I just have to keep moving. And so I got into this bad sleep deficit where I was just constantly tired and I'd have to switch my sleep schedule where I slept during the daytime and I'd have to move during the night so I wouldn't get cold. Because I couldn't get resupplies from anyone. I couldn't get more gear. It's what I started with. It was what I had. And that's sort of the honoring the style of fast packing. I wouldn't say there was a point where I came close to quitting, but there was these moments where I was like, it was really hard, really difficult. But I'll be honest and say I was just very excited to be doing something that I had been planning for so long. And that part really kept me moving and motivated.
How did it feel to accomplish that? How did it feel to finally get to your goal? What was going through your mind?
It was so satisfying, but it was so fleeting. I think that was the thing. I spent all this time hyping it up, my brain and all the training and everything. And then you finish it and it's exciting for like a day or two when you can barely walk. And it's just all that pain and discomfort's a reminder of all the work that you put in. But eventually life moves on. You're like, I think that ego, inner ego is like, well, this is now behind me. Mm-hmm. People move on, you move on. And it's hard to think beyond big goals like this. And you can often have this like little bout of depression, you could equate it to like getting a lot of money. It didn't like solve anything. You're still yourself. You're still the person you are that you have to deal with every day. And so I think it just left me, one, I was like honestly really satisfied because you put all this work in doing this and it, and realizing that you're capable of doing these feats that you might not have believed in, or maybe step back and get some perspective a couple of years ago. You couldn't fathom doing it. And now here you are. And I think the biggest thing was like, all right, I have this in the tool set. What else can I do? What other goals are going to excite me? So it's like trying to latch on to the next adventure that's going to help keep you excited to keep being in the mountains.
Now, after you accomplished that goal, what ideas did you have in your head, or where do you feel like the direction of your life went?
I realized that there was a lot of power in social media at the time. This was Instagram. There's a lot of Snapchat in there for stories because Instagram stories weren't out, but what was fun was sharing the adventure with other people and having this ability to do real-time adventure storytelling. People could follow along, and I had an audience, and it's like that audience was paying attention. What other ways can I leverage this audience to do fun stuff? There was this part of me, like, I'm not a professional athlete, you know, but I wanted to see if I could make a living or get projects approved by brands and have brands either pay me, give me gear, promote, cross promote, and build this personal reputation as like an adventurer. Cause you see other people doing it and you're like, well, that's the dream. I want to be doing that. There's like the stroke of the ego to get this recognition, to get the kudos on all the stuff we do on the, and get these accolades and get rewarded for it. And that can come in many different forms. This continued with skiing and backcountry skiing. And I wanted to go ski all these remote regions, the White Mountains. I spent 2 or 3 years straight skiing as much as possible. Every nook and cranny I could get into, given the conditions, I was just dead set on making that happen. And at the same time, I'm trying to make a living. As I mentioned, I started to get some ski gear and the specialized modern backcountry ski gear and get people introduced to it. And I was working out of my basement / back of my truck, and they're just like, it was very little traction, but it afforded me the time. Because when business is slow, you're like, well, I got to market, I got to do this stuff. But I was spending that time out in the mountain getting video and photos and then putting these videos up on YouTube. And then eventually I had this awesome portfolio of adventures that was good, but I still needed to do stuff with this business. I had to make a living. And it's not that fun to be in the mountains and be stressed out about your money, your financial situation, and your life direction. So I had a guy reach out to me that was a ski patroller up at the ski area up the road from me, Black Mountain. And he said, hey, there's this little space here. You should come look at it. Maybe you could use it for like a gear storage or something. Yeah, that's not a bad idea. A gear drop. Because if people are coming up to the White Mountains, we're up in Jackson, which is pretty much the gateway to Mount Washington, where everyone does backcountry skiing. And I went and looked at it and I thought, yeah, this can work. I can get this little space. It was a nursery and I'll make it work. And next thing you know, it became a rental hub for backcountry ski rentals. And I had this resource of Black Mountain right out the door where I could send customers to try the backcountry ski gear. So now they rent it, they try it, and if they like it, they can buy their own setup. And this was the business model that developed over time. I was able to do events too, which was another great thing, because there's a nighttime ski touring event I started called Friday Night Lights, which we're in our fifth season of. But this was like what do you want to do? What events do you want to do that don't exist? This has led to many other events that we host. But if you're looking back on the business side of things, Andrew Drummond, the business, which I think initially was, but then there was this switch that flipped where it was Ski the Whites. It can be so much bigger and has so much more potential than me as an individual. This was like the biggest learning moment I had, I think, about what I was doing, was that I could reach so many more people if I just make this not about me at all and make it all about a brand that represents things that people are connected to. That's the community, the outdoors, but really breaking down this barrier for people to get into backcountry skiing. I think that's essentially what it came down to. And so there was a sweepstakes giveaway that I was supporting, and this company asked me, he's like, do you want to direct people to your personal Instagram account or to the Ski the Whites Instagram account? And that was like, that was the moment where I started pushing people to Ski the Whites, and I let go of my ego And I was like, this isn't about me. This is about this opportunity to like build something bigger than I'll ever be.
Why do you think the whites and the East Coast skiing is overlooked?
The quick and easy one is that a lot of these outdoor companies are based in Colorado or California. So it's not in their backyard. I think it's not as glamorous. You don't have the winter conditions, the annual snowfall, the bigger mountains that you do out west. It always drove me nuts. A perfect example was the Patagonia Freeport store. I gave a presentation there. I walk in, look up on the wall. There's a beautiful picture of Lac Blanc in Chamonix with a runner. And I was like, why don't you have something from Katahdin, Baxter State Park, that's in your state, a beautiful image? Why would you have something that's not relatable to most people coming in? That sort of set me on this mission to work with all these brands and be like, you have such a big market segment between Boston, Massachusetts, New York, Portland, Maine, and everywhere in between that all can access these mountains in a drive. They don't have to book a ticket. They don't have to, you know, just hop in a car and they can get here. So why wouldn't you market towards this audience? So that was the big thing for me. It was like doing a lot of work to work with photo editors and these different companies to get imagery from the Northeast for their catalogs and their stores. Yeah, I don't know. It was one of those moments where it rubbed me the wrong way. One part of it's pride, but if you're a business, like why wouldn't you want to market to your region?
Now, I've heard the phrase, it's something to the extent of, if you can ski the Northeast or if you can ski the whites or ski East, then you can ski anywhere. What does that phrase mean and what are they talking about when they say that?
Most of that's derived from the icy conditions, the firm conditions, and it involves this technical style of skiing or alpinism that you're just not going to get as frequently if you're someplace with a higher annual snowfall. If you have to deal with icy boilerplate man-made snow, you have to learn how to control your edges and have proper technique. Because if you don't, you're just going to be sliding all around and you're not going to enjoy it. The Northeast is so good for alpine ski racing. It's because we have just firm technical snow that you can't cheat on. And the same is to be said with Mount Washington for alpinism, is that if you can ski and mix climb and ice climb and rock climb here, you can take those skills anywhere in the world. I look at someone like Chris Davenport that sort of cut his teeth here and then he's gone on to have this like illustrious big mountain career. But eventually you need to go somewhere else and get this perspective and go adventure in the bigger mountains and see what it's all about, because there's something like really special about getting that experience and then knowing where you came from and coming back here and applying those skills back here. And I did this in reverse, because I went out and I learned how to backcountry ski in Alaska in the like real big mountains, but then came back here and I was like, why aren't more people doing it back here? Cause there was like really small fragmented user group, but it wasn't quite there. When I came back, I had just such a blast. And I think the big takeaway is just anytime you're spending in the mountains, you're going to be better for it. And wanting to introduce people and get people outdoor, it's not like I want to crowd the mountains and blow up all the trailheads and make it this unpleasant experience. But I think just as a society, people are in such better moods and such happier people if they can spend time outdoors.
Yeah. Something that we talk about within my inner circle is finding that balance between being mindful and trying to document what's going on during that time where you're trying to generate revenue. How do you draw the line between, or could you do both? I don't know.
No, that workflow is a tricky balance. And I think for some people to be present, to leave the camera at home or leave their phone in their car, it's like very few and far between. Like a lot of people can't do that. I think you can still really enjoy the moment and be present with a camera, with your phone. It's up to you to how you want to experience it. I think I've always loved to document my adventure. Anything I do in the mountains, or, you know, when the digital cameras first came out in what, 99 or so, I remember I had like the Sony Mavica that used a floppy disk, you know? So it's like, I feel like I've had film cameras before that, but I don't think it's anything new, whether it's a digital camera, a phone, social media. I think with connectivity, that's changing, where you're more likely to get distracted from what you're doing. Mm-hmm. Emails showing up and that stuff. That's the being present, because you can be a photographer. People have been photographers for years and long before I got into this. in the mountains, but to be connected via the internet is different. That's, I think, the problem, because when I get LTE service up above tree line, it's not always great. It's not like that's really taking me away from the moment. Not like a camera taking a photo is like, that excites me. And that's part of what gets me outdoors sometimes. So it works both ways. But yeah, there has to be a fine line. You can't be fully distracted. You have to step back and enjoy the reasons for being out there in the first place.
Now back to Scott, the ultra marathon runner. What did you learn from him? What are some of the key lessons that you learned, you took away from him?
Man, so my introduction to Scott was like, I read about him in all these books and I watched documentaries, and he was the main character in Born to Run. When I learned about ultra marathons, it was learning about Scott. It was just really funny that when I got to meet him, he was not who I read about. He was just worn down. He was emaciated. He was having a really hard time. He'd just come out of Vermont, which was just a rugged experience with torrential rain and just a really wet trail, very challenging conditions. And he had a little bit of an edge to him, and I liked it. And he wasn't moving that fast, not nearly as fast as he wanted to be moving, but he just like kept moving and kept going, wouldn't like no sleep, and just got it done. And so he's sort of like, he wasn't quite who I thought he was, but he definitely lived up to the hype of someone that just was going to go and tackle this big project. It's infectious when someone else achieves something. And I see this with all the events we run. When someone hits a goal, it really makes you self-reflect and want some of that. You're like, whatever that guy's or girl's feeling, I want some of that, because it's got to be so satisfying to finish the race or finish this project. That's what I really got out of meeting Scott. And I learned is like, you can affect other people by sharing these projects and races or events, whatever you're doing, that you just never know who's going to watch it or follow along, and it's going to change their life.
Yeah, that dovetails right into the core of the podcast. Is when you think about legacy, what do you think of, and what type of legacy do you want to leave?
That's a really hard question. I think we tend to live so much in the moment and not think big picture. We just look at, I'm downstairs today, cleaning up, taking out the trash, packaging up stuff. I'm sort of on autopilot, doing just these little things. When you have questions like this, it's such a big question that, I mean, it's such a big idea and concept that it's really hard to place. But what I do at the business here is we've become like a retail shop. We do events, we do services. There's lots of fun moving parts. We started roasting coffee downstairs. But what really makes me happy day to day is like the community, and it's the people. I mean, selling fun ski gears, you're still doing retail. And I think it's okay. There's some satisfaction in that, but it's not like, doesn't make me tick. But what makes me tick is connecting people. When you think about legacy, what's going to live on? And I think these people and their connection to the outdoors, and if you had any part in helping them along the way or introducing them, it's viral. They introduce it to someone else and it just spreads. That's what I care about now. I mean, that's like really what I live for, and it genuinely makes me the most happy. So if I can disappear and know that this is still out there and people are still sharing what I love and my passion with other people, then that's it right there.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time to talk about your story. I think this will be a interesting out of the box type of episode. And I really appreciate you taking the time to just share some of your insights. And it's actually inspired me to drive up to the Whites this year once some snow hits the ground. Anything you want our audience to know or where to find you?
I'm easy to find. I'm usually working in the shop by the phone or in front of the computer. SkiTheWhites.com. You can find everything. And then I'm probably most active on Instagram on the Ski the Whites hashtag. I want people, if they're curious about the outdoors, about trail running, about biking, about skiing, to just pick up the phone, give us a call, or just reach out. You know, it really helps to get advice and some counsel from someone else. You know, we're here to, there's no like stupid questions. Everyone was a beginner. And if we can help you skip a lot of the mistakes, there's that level of mentorship. I just want to be available. So yeah, spend more time outside, get in the mountains, and everyone will be better for it.
Thanks, Andrew. Have a good one.
All right. Thanks, Paul.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Legacy Podcast. Now, if you can do us a favor and leave a review, any type of stars on any platform that you use, it would be greatly appreciated. For more information about us, the other co-hosts, and the Legacy Podcast, go to businesslegacypodcast.com. That's businesslegacypodcast.com. Have a great day.